This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Ralph Pointer from Washington, where he's advocating for compassionate release for Lynn Stewart.
Ralph's Lynn's husband for 35 years, comrade, down in Washington, D.C., standing in front of the White House, says he won't move until Lynn Stewart is let out of prison.
We'll talk about the city of Detroit and the largest municipal bankruptcy in history.
Detroit went from the fourth largest city in the United States, the really capital of black nationalism in the 60s, to a city diminished to only one-third of its population, and its history put into question.
We remember journalist and author Henri Alleg, who died a few weeks ago. We'll talk with his friend and colleague, Marnia Lazarek.
Henri Alleg's account of his waterboarding at the hands of the French colonial paratroopers in Algiers is one of the few and extraordinarily moving, effective accounts of what it means to be tortured.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
We're joined now by Michael Ratner via phone. We want to talk with Michael about the CIA agent Bob Lady, who was in charge of the CIA station in Milan, responsible for kidnapping an Arab man, renditioning him to Egypt, where he was tortured. He was in Panama. He was picked up. He should have been tried. And instead, the United States exerted pressure on the Panamanians and let him free. Michael, what do you think about it?
Now, last week, we received some pretty exciting news. A man, former CIA agent named Robert Selden Lady, former CIA station chief in Italy, was actually arrested in Panama on an international Interpol warrant. And what was he arrested for? Well, apparently the warrant, which had been issued by Italy, because he had been convicted of kidnapping the Egyptian cleric Abu Omar off the streets of Milan. It's been a trial that's been going on and off for years, but ultimately the CIA station chief and 21 other CIA officials were convicted of the kidnapping and then the sending of Abu Omar, the Egyptian cleric, to Egypt, where he was brutally, brutally tortured. None of them appeared at their trial. They were all tried in absentia. All were convicted. Lady got the highest sentence of 9 years. It was upheld by the court. And then apparently, unbeknownst to most of us, this international arrest warrant was issued. Now, had he appeared at trial, of course, he would have been there. It wouldn't have been in absentia. But if and when he's ever taken back to Italy, he will get a new trial because, well, no one loves in absentia trials. You do get a new trial if you go back. So here we're all excited about this news. CIA station chief from Italy arrested. You know, incredible message it sent. Here you have 500 CIA agents, it's estimated, that have been involved in the extraordinary rendition program, or in other words, the sending of people to torture all over the world under Bush and conceivably under Obama as well on occasion, although we don't have the proof of it yet, but it apparently has not necessarily discontinued. But here you have 500 agents, and here you get one arrested. And so agents are now going to be afraid, completely terrified of leaving the United States, because when and if will they be arrested? So we were very excited by this. At the same time, it didn't take long for probably some combination of U.S. pressure and some other factors to get Robert Selden Lady, former CIA station chief, out of prison in Panama and on a plane back to the United States. So I had great hopes, but they were dashed. But at the same time, as I want to emphasize again, CIA station chief or CIA officials leave the United States and whose names are known are in deep trouble because it's likely there's warrants for them all over the place. Let's talk a minute about the trial and then about what happened with the warrant. We covered this issue extensively on our show of the trial. We interviewed Steve Hendricks, who wrote a book, Kidnapping in Milan. I would strongly recommend listening to the show. It's quite interesting, particularly on how he was tortured, as well as how actually a very well-known prosecutor in Italy, Armando Spataro, was able to trace down and figure out the CIA people involved by using the cell phones of the agents. Even when they weren't making calls, of course, they're tracked constantly, as every cell phone is, by the local towers in the area. Spataro was able to do it. He was able to buck the Italian government to do it. Ultimately, he was able to take these people to trial and got these convictions. Italy didn't like it, in the sense that the government of Italy didn't like it, but prosecutors are very independent in Italy, and Spataro got it through. Then it was said that Italy wouldn't really issue arrest warrants, or they didn't ask for the extradition, which is true. They did not ask for the extradition of any of the agents from the United States, but apparently, probably not even by the Italian government itself, but these Interpol arrest warrants were issued by likely prosecutors in Italy, and they're all over the world. So here you have Robert Selden Lady, the CIA agent, trying to get into Costa Rica, apparently from Panama. He's sent back to Panama. When he goes back, they look at him on a list, and he's on an Interpol warrant list. Now, the question people are asking is, was it lawful for the Panamanian government to simply disregard the Interpol warrant, or at least disregard it after they had arrested him, and let him go back to the United States? The first thing to understand is there's no extradition treaty between Panama and Italy, so that any efforts by Italy to get the CIA, the former CIA station chief, on this arrest warrant would have had been carried out through a bilateral relationship. In the normal course, Panama should have turned him over to Italy. They said, you have 2 months to come up with reasons we should turn him over to you. They said something like that, but before Italy could even move, he was back on a plane to the United States. The first thing that happened here is that Panama didn't even enter into the bilateral negotiations with Italy about sending the CIA station chief back. A second point, and I think an important legal point, is that Panama, like Italy, has signed the UN Convention Against Torture. And that actually is very specific. That says that if a torturer appears in your country, sets foot in your country, in this case Panama, has the obligation to arrest and either try that person or extradite him to the place where he should be extradited to, in this case, Italy, where the torture occurred, or at least the setting up of the torture occurred by sending Abu Omar to Egypt. So they have an obligation under that, apart from the obligation they had actually having executed the arrest warrant, and they obviously just ignored that. It's as if the Convention Against Torture didn't exist. So you have this extraordinary case in which, again, a country just utterly bowed to the wishes of the United States and the power of the United States. I don't imagine the U.S. even had to pick up the phone. I don't have the proof that they did. But this is little Panama sitting down there, which is essentially a neo-colony of the United States with its, you know, the canal that splits the country in half, et cetera. And so it's unlikely they would have ever wanted to do anything with a U.S. CIA agent. In fact, they said it was a mistake that he was arrested. It wasn't really a mistake in the sense that he's on an Interpol arrest warrant so that he would be taken in. I think one thing we ought to think about is the contrast in this case. Here you have a guy who has actually been convicted of sending a person to torture, kidnapping a person, and violating the sovereignty of another country, Italy in this case, this Robert Selden Lady, the CIA chief. And the U.S. Gets him back immediately. There's no cries for prosecuting him. But in the case of someone like Edward Snowden, what does the U.S. do? They do everything they can to get their hands on him, to try him. So the U.S. hypocrisy, duplicity, and criminality is illustrated clearly by this case. The last note on this, again, is what I began it with. What a wonderful message the first part of this arrest sends. It sends a message, as I said, to every one of these people, whether it's George Bush or CIA agents or others who are in the administration, formulating, carrying out torture, that they are not safe anywhere in the world except in the United States. The last point I think is important, as I had mentioned, Snowden, as we speak to you today on this show, that apparently Edward Snowden has been granted a temporary residence or asylum permit in Russia and will hopefully be leaving the transit lounge of the airport outside of Moscow, and at least in Russia, while he waits his efforts to get into a Latin American country, a number of which have already promised him asylum. So that's very good news. So in some way, I'd summarize this as two pieces of good news, one bad. The good is getting Robert Zeldin Lady arrested and the message it sends. The good is Edward Snowden getting asylum, or at least a temporary permit. The bad is that, of course, the United States, again, trying to protect its own torturers as well as prosecute those who reveal its torture. So it's been a pretty remarkable week, showing that this torture program of the United States, and I once said our hands are deeply involved in the blood of torture, particularly the administration, will continue to bite the torturers back, and hopefully we'll one day see them brought to justice.
Disbarred activist attorney, political prisoner, and our friend Lynn Stewart has recently been denied compassionate release from the prison she's in Fort Worth, Texas. Lynn is suffering from stage 4 cancer. It's an incurable cancer that's spread to other parts of her body, including her lungs. Although the warden at her prison in Carswell signed off on her compassionate release, the head of the Bureau of Prisons, Samuels, had his lawyer write Lynn saying, quote, "She does not present circumstances considered extraordinary and compelling at this time," end quote. Lynn was initially sentenced to 28 months on a conviction for materially aiding terrorism. The aid to terrorism conviction stemmed from her issuing a press release on behalf of her client, Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman. Initially, Lynn's press release was overlooked by the Clinton administration, but when Bush came to office and 9/11 happened, they looked backward, tried to pick out a target that they could make an example of, chose Lynn Stewart, had the attorney general at the time fly to New York and announce that he was indicting her on the David Letterman show, and then conduct a show trial down in Foley Square. Lynn's 28-month sentence wasn't enough for the government. They went to the Court of Appeals, which you can do in federal court, and the Court of Appeals, which had Bush's cousin, Judge Walker, sitting on it, pressured the trial judge to increase the sentence, which he did, to 10 years. Lynn is now dying in prison. The judge said he didn't want to see her dying in prison, but the Bureau of Prison, in defiance of its own law, won't let her out. We speak today with Lynn's husband, Ralph Poynter, who visits her regularly, who conducted a hunger strike in front of the White House, and who will give us an update on the situation.
Welcome, Ralph, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, Heidi.
You're standing in front of the White House, and before we hear what's happening there, we wanted to start by asking you when the last time you saw Lynn was, and how is she doing?
I saw her the 4th of July weekend. Her spirits are great, but her body is dying. And when I described what she looked like to our daughter, she cried, and I said, "What did I say?" She didn't answer me, but we have a problem. And then it's in her waning days, and we're trying to get her home so she can die surrounded by people who care about her and under more congenial circumstances.
Ralph, you've been demonstrating in front of the White House for several weeks now.
June 17th was the first day. And I only took a break to come after Lynn had received her denial of compassionate release. You can hear the carrying on in the background. And she said I should go back and do the radio interviews, et cetera. I went back to New York for 2 days, and then I've been back here ever since. So we're building an interest and an understanding of what has happened here.
Ralph, what's the status with Judge Codal? Has he been approached about this, given the...
Papers will go before Judge Codal Friday to ask him to get involved. We don't know what the result of these will be, but it is the medical records. We've had to fight the Bureau of Prisons to get all of Lynn's medical records. They insisted, they first told the lawyers that they had to go before the Freedom of Information Act to get Lynn's medical records. Lynn wrote a personal letter saying that they should give up all of her medical records. Several doctors have written, one from Sloan Kettering, and doctors, you know, Richard Dundee, they have said Lynn is going to die. And one of the doctors in the prison is resubmitting Lynn's compassionate release because she says it is her oath to understand and tell the truth what is happening, even though the Bureau of Prisons has denied it. In the letter, they said Lynn is getting better. Well, she just got out of quarantine because of the way blood cells were down. They can't treat her the way they treated her before in terms of the chemo. I think it was the Red Devil because of all of the side effects. And so she is not improving, and they can't give her the medicine that they think is going to help her. But Lynn struggles on. We hope that Judge Codal, who had said before that he didn't want to give Lynn Stewart a death sentence while she's dying, let's see if he can keep his word.
Are you calling for people to write to Codal the way we collected letters years ago from her supporters in New York City, or does that come later?
Well, I hadn't thought of that, but now that you've said it, I think it would be a good idea if it is coming, you know, like up from the people. Many people wrote to Judge Codal, and I would include, if you'd be giving the address to Eric Holder, President Obama, and Samuelson.
Ralph, we're going to put the addresses and phone numbers of those people up on our website at Law and Disorder, and also remind people that they can go to lynnstewart.org. Or lawanddisorder.org for that information. But I wanted to ask you to comment on the cynicism of the head of the Bureau of Prison and his attorney to say that the compassionate release law doesn't apply in this situation.
If I were to say that, then you would not be allowed to repeat the words on your radio station. But as Lynn said, they have misstated her condition. I say they boldly lied. That's why we're submitting papers and her medical records to show that they lied about her condition.
What is the response from the people on the street in D.C. who may or may not have heard? Good. And have some of them not heard about Lynn and are shocked to learn?
Yes, and they want to hear more. I was up at Howard University. The students there have called two events, and I will hope that they will continue to call events. I will continue this until Lynn is home or she's out in a box. And so they understand that. The Ethical Culture Society, I believe in Washington, we have a meeting for, I believe it is Tuesday, but I'm not keeping up. Paulette from the Jericho Movement is keeping the papers, so she knows when the dates are for meetings, and I'm expecting a meeting from the Terry Redd, Washington, D.C. spokesperson, who has a radio program, to be here any moment to discuss the story of Lynn Stewart. So I'm working as hard as I can because I think Lynn deserves our support. Her 35 years of great work, no, over 50 years. She was an activist before she was a lawyer. We have to support that. We don't support our political prisoners. We are not a movement.
So, we're not a civilization, indeed. How are the police treating you?
They have been, everyone has been cooperative except one particular policeman. He wanted to tell me where to stand, and I refused. You know, I stood around my materials, and I said, well, how many feet should I have? And he wouldn't say it. So I said, well, then I just have to use my own judgment, and I did. I was conservative. I stayed near my materials, but I walked around passing out papers. He walked away. And I will not tell you what the other officers said about them. It might get them all in trouble. Anyway, so I have had no problem with the police here.
Ralph, I want to give out the phone number of Charles Samuels, the head of the U.S. Bureau of Prisons, and his phone number. If people will write this down, give him a call. I know he'd like to hear from you, 202-307-3198. That's 202-307-3198, extension 3. Give him a call. Tell him that you're a friend of Michael Smith and Heidi Boghossian and Michael Ratner and Ralph Pointer, and tell him he should do the right thing. And Ralph, we're with you every minute out there. We're thinking about Lynn, and we'll talk to you very soon.
Thank you so much for reminding people of Lynn. I will be doing my best every day, all day, and if people have going to Washington, stop by to see me for 5, 10, 15 minutes and bring a cold bottle of water.
Okay.
Good luck, Ralph.
Bye, Ralph.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Detroit, Michigan, once the fourth largest city in America, has been taken into bankruptcy. People living in Detroit now face the alternative of having the city's money go to the bankers and big corporations who own city bonds, or go to the pensioners in Detroit, the former city workers who had a deferred salary from their work, go to their medical benefits, and the money go to the services in the city of Detroit. The fights between the big banks and the corporations who own the bonds and the people who live there and many of the people who used to work there. We're joined today by former auto worker Mike Hamlin to talk more about the fight in Detroit. Mike Hamlin was a co-founder of the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. He worked in the plants for many years, became a social worker, and is now currently a professor of Africana Studies at Wayne State University. Mike Hamlin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
We wanted to start by asking you what Detroit was like when you arrived there as a young child and contrast it to what it's like now.
Well, I came here from sharecropping country in Mississippi, and so it was quite a shock to say the least. We landed in a suburb of Detroit that was segregated, blacks on one side of the track and whites on the other. Well, we went to integrated high school and junior high, but at grade two level, we were separate. And many people from the area I came from were located in the same area. My father was run out of Mississippi, just ahead of the sheriff. His sister lived here, so we lived in a project with a two-bedroom apartment with them and with my aunt and her husband and our two kids, and that was me, my sister, my mother, and my dad. So there were eight of us in this two-bedroom apartment. My father was able to find a job in construction, and I started school. Now, the first day in school, the kids laughed at me, and matter of fact, the teacher led the laugh. I mentioned in my book that a teacher said, well, Mr. Hamlin, you did something wrong. I forget what it was, and I told him I didn't aim to do it, and he laughed, and everybody laughed. So it had quite an impact on me. It made me want to learn and study, and I studied. I was a fierce competitor, and became in spelling and grammar. So that desire to learn was fuel there, and in fact, it stayed with me all through high school and college, even after. But the town, the people took care and looked out for each other. All the parents would keep me in check, and my parents would help with the rest of the kids in the area. My father was a reckless and irresponsible man, so we had a tough time. My mother was only 15 years older than me, so we kind of grew up together and raised my sister, who was sheltered. But it was a peaceful working-class community, also sometimes disrupted on weekends by a lot of drinking, arguing, and spouse abuse.
You've worked for over 35 years as a social worker, and you're currently a professor at Wayne State University. What is the Detroit that you're seeing now like in contrast to the earlier one?
Well, at that time, we were so completely repressed and segregated that it was kind of, those of us from the South were prepared for that, because in the South you had to learn to keep your place. You know, so we submitted, and we played the game. It either was go to school or go in a factory. Now, by the time I got to be 17 or 18, most of my friends were going in the factory, quitting school, going in the factory. My father advised me to do the same, and I wouldn't. And then when my best friend, who had been my mentor, even though he was younger than me, and had his way paved with a scholarship at U of M, decided to go to U of M. I decided to go with him. I didn't know what I was going to take, and it was really an alien experience for me because there were 33,000 students there, 300 blacks. Anyway, the factories at that time were hiring, and my father eventually got into Ford. And most of the workers there were either worked at Ford or Great Lakes Steel. So they were workers, and they were going about their business, trying to make a living. They prospered. They really prospered. There were articles in Ebony and Jet about black Detroiters and the wealth that they were accumulating. And the typical pattern was when they moved to the north, got a job in the plant, they'd buy a new car and go back down south and show their friends and the white folks. And that, you know, I'm sure that created a lot of angst. My cousin and her husband moved to Detroit. He got a job, and 1 year after he got his job at Ford, he bought a 1955 fire engine red Fairlane and drove back down south and rode around. He used to be quite a cotton picker. He was, you know, they picked enormous loads of cotton. But, you know, so the Ford job was like, you know, played to him. So he worked a lot of overtime, and that was typical. They're kind of typical. I didn't think it was a good idea to go back down there in these fancy cars. Some of them would drive Cadillacs. They still do that.
You know, my father grew up as an orphan in Chicago, poor as you folks were. And that's what he did, too. He always had a new Cadillac when those years he could afford it, you know, and he always had a nice suit when he could afford it. But, Mike, let's get back to Detroit. In those days, of course, it was a booming, populous town. People could make a living, so they were called, I think it's not a good description, but they're called the middle class. They're still workers, but they're making a decent living, and the kids could go to school like you did, or like our friend John Watson was able to do, or Luke Tripp. Mm-hmm. And then you had the formation of a real intellectual black leadership in the town in the 60s and early 70s, and you were part of that, and you write about that in your book, A Black Revolutionary's Life and Labor, Black Workers' Power in Detroit. And it's a story about the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers and people that joined it, the people that supported it, including white people. And things were politically pretty interesting in those days. And I wanted to ask you if you could contrast the movement then to what's going on in Detroit now with the bankruptcy that the city's been forced into. Who's getting hurt by it and what kind of movement's going on now?
Okay. In our case, as you probably heard me say when I was in New York, we acted out of desperation. And I think most people who will take the risk of the Klan themselves revolutionary and acting on that realize they're taking an enormous risk. But the reason you do that is that you don't have any other choice. And we didn't. Our plight was so horrible. We're dealing with so much police brutality. People's houses are burned down when they move into a neighborhood. There had been a riot in 43, and that still lingers. The situation with bankruptcy is kind of like a culmination. First of all, if you know black history, there's a history of destroying black communities that are prosperous. You look at Tulsa, Rosewood, and then in the 1919, the Red Scare period, there were 30-some black towns destroyed because they had been prosperous. You know, the envy that poor whites had around that was played upon to destroy them. They literally destroyed these cities. And here in Detroit, the real estate companies began to move blacks into white neighborhoods, causing great conflict, actually promoted white flight to get to make the houses available to blacks, but really to make money. And they made lots of money, blockbusting, as they call it, in that time. So there has always been a bitter hatred in the state of Michigan throughout on the part of blacks toward whites. To show you where it is, even today, Livonia, which adjoins Detroit on the west side, is the most segregated city, over 100,000 in the country to date. And Dearborn had this slogan, keep Dearborn clean, and everybody knew that what they meant was keep blacks out. So it was that kind of environment that we grew up in, and the police kept the order. We lived in a virtual police state in this city. There are various interests involved in this. First of all, to get the whites out of here and get blacks in, but then they had a segment of the power structure that holds to the colonialist idea that blacks can't govern themselves. They're like children. And so, you know, they fed off of what some corrupt politicians did to justify coming to the... So this bankruptcy has been in the making for a long time, and the racial aspect of it should not be underplayed or underestimated. People outside of Detroit have been tearing it down since the 50s, been talking about what a horror it is, and done that all over the world in the same way that during slavery, to justify slavery, American tourists and politicians and businessmen spread around the world that blacks were inferior and this and that. People outside the city have this hatred and this dislike and desire to see it crumble. Brooks Patterson, who's a powerful politician, ahead of Oakland County, one of the richest counties in the country, said in this Shevitz's book, that he doesn't give a damn about Detroit. He hopes it's destroyed. He's a very powerful Republican, probably the most powerful Republican over the years in the state of Michigan. There's joy in Mudville now that Detroit is bankrupt. People don't know that there's another side to this because the businesses are coming into the downtown. Quicken Loans gives his employees incentives to move into downtown loft and apartment complexes. Blue Cross has done the same thing, CompuWare. So, you know, businesses are coming in, they're claiming land, building up, housing units, and the downtown is flourishing, and people are, you know, on the weekends, at night, people are downtown. But the image of Detroit all over the world now is a disaster.
What do you make of the struggle that's going on now with the bankruptcy? You know, we learned in law school that the definition of bankruptcy was when an entity or a person couldn't pay their bills as they became due. That's the situation in Detroit. On the one hand, you got the rich bankers and corporations that own the bonds that the city of Detroit sold them. They took the risk and they bought them, and they're creditors. And then the other creditors are the workers who worked for the city of Detroit who got a deferred payment in the form of a pension and health care. Now they're thrown into bankruptcy, and the bankruptcy court's going to say, well, everybody's going to have to take a haircut here. The pensions are going to have to be cut or eliminated, and the medical care is going to be gone. We're sorry, you bankers, you took a risk, so we're going to give you a little less than you expected. Isn't the real question about those bankers buying the bonds, they took the risk, they should get nothing. And moreover, if the United States could bail out the banks, they could bail out Detroit.
But it didn't happen. I think you were in a meeting when Ron Riassi spoke and talked about how Coleman Young had given General Motors $500 million of city money. GM, of course, got bailed out. GM is in good position now. They're not bailing out the city. The government's not bailing out the city. But part of what Riassi said was that in giving that money to GM, Coleman paid for it by giving the block grant money for 12 years that was coming to Detroit. And I tell you this, Detroit is going to prosper again, not too far in the far distant future. There is plenty of businesses moving downtown, all kind of new little shops opening. And, you know, they put in a river walk. The population is changing. It was 85% black. It hasn't been counted recently. There is a change. And, they're still blight. There are still these buildings, broken down buildings and that kind of thing. But Snyder's not giving any help either, the governor. He said that he will not give any direct aid to Detroit. And the city council and the mayor, before they declared bankruptcy, said that the state owed the city $100 million, but they wouldn't pay it. This was coming, Mike. And you could see it coming. They've been talking about it for a long time. I'm sure there was corruption. You know, the right wing has been plotting for years to eliminate black control and black governance of this city. And that's going to happen. There's a white candidate now for mayor who is likely to win with a lot of black support, even though he's a write-in.
That's interesting. I don't want to miss the chance to tell our listeners about your book and ask you how to get it. The book is called A Black Revolutionary's Life and Labor, Black Workers' Power in Detroit. If you'll go to a search engine, you can get it. Or you can go to againstthetidebooks.com and pick up a copy of Mike Hamlin's autobiography of his days in Detroit. Wonderful book.
Against the Tide Books.
Great. Again, we've been talking to Mike Hamlin, one of the founders of the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers in Detroit in the 60s. He's still in there punching. I saw him recently at the Left Forum where he was on a panel with Dan Georgiakis talking about the book Detroit, I Do Mind Dying. And Mike has written his own memoir of his life coming up in Detroit called A Black Revolutionary's Life in Labor. And we urge people to get a hold of a copy. It's a wonderful book. We thank you so much, both Heidi and I, for
Mike.
Being on Law and Disorder.
I thank you guys so much. Let me just say one thing. I am so encouraged by all the meetings that I've been invited to all around the city, and it's constant. People are meeting just about every week or demonstrating against the bankruptcy or the Trayvon Martin situation. I really appreciate it.
Good to hear. Take care.
Take care, Mike.
Bye-bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
We were fortunate to interview French-Algerian journalist Henri Elleg. Henri passed away last week. He was 91 years old. In 2007, we talked with him about his book, The Question, a moving account of his arrest and torture at the hands of French paratroopers during the Algerian War of Independence. The book became a bestseller and stirred major public debate in France. The preface, written by Jean-Paul Sartre, remains a relevant commentary on the moral and political effects of torture on both the victim and the perpetrator. The book was eventually banned by the authorities. We remember Henri Elleg with our returning guest, Marnia Lazreg. She's a professor of sociology at Hunter College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Her book, Torture in the Twilight of Empire, From Algiers to Baghdad, links the use of torture to the demise of empire. Marnia, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
We thought we'd start by asking you to tell our listeners a bit about yourself and how you came to meet Henri Elleg.
Let's see. I had worked on the issue of torture during the Algerian War, 1954-62. Then, of course, in doing my research, I read Henri Elleg's La Question, The Question. And really struck a chord with me. There were times during my research and writing where I had lost complete faith in humanity, or even the notion of humanism, which of course we were taught in French schools. You know, I went to a Franco-French school, not a school for native girls, and of course I knew there was a disconnect. You know, I lived in the Arab area in the city where I was going to high school, and I could see, every morning on my way to the high school, hundreds of men lining up, outside the Bureau de Chômage, unemployment office. The war was raging. So I was reading the papers, that, seemed to indicate, that the French were winning the war. And, the Algerian combatants were called Felaga, which is a term that the French has used against the nationalists in Tunisia, which in Arabic means the splitters, splitting something is, falag. So they were the Felaga. I knew there was a disconnect between what I was, being taught, in high school and what I was living. But then when I started doing the research on torture, and I realized how it was really a systematic practice, then I would come across these pictures of one in particular struck me. It was a man, in the countryside, a farmer, a rural man dressed like, rural men dressed, at the time. And he was in the middle of nowhere in the field. That's what the picture showed. And there were four French soldiers holding him down, and another one with the portable generator, actually activating it to, inflict on him torture by electricity. And it was, for some reason, I had seen other pictures, but that one really shook me up, because it was a picture of total, absolute, complete helplessness. And this man who was, probably, was a very innocent man in the middle of nowhere being, given, this treatment. And then I read La Question, the question by Alec, and I, realized, he was speaking to me. As an Algerian, person who had been tortured would be speaking to me about the ordeal that he had gone through. And he was a Frenchman. But later on, of course, when I read about his biography, he was, a special kind of Frenchman. And but there it was, he was treated the same way any Algerian member of the Front of National Liberation was treated, which meant, tortured mercilessly. And he kept, the struggle, he kept resisting, and he didn't talk, he didn't crack. And not only he didn't do all of that, but he was essentially the first, a French, intellectual who blew the whistle, if you will, on the hypocrisy of the colonial military establishment, which, was, spreading, all this news that they were in Algeria to really save the country from a band, of, gangsters who wanted to take it over, when in fact they were actually waging a war against the Algerian population itself.
Let me ask you the significance of the title of Alec's book, The Question, because as I understand it, he didn't answer any questions that they asked him, particularly the first one.
Right.
And so why did he call the book The Question?
Oh, that's a very interesting question, if you will. The Question was actually a torture used during the Middle Ages in France. Remember, the ordeals, were widespread at that time. In order to make someone talk, you had to subject them to the ordeals. And, one of them was called the question, la question, which meant you essentially you're asking a question. You're putting a question. You're interrogating the person. To make the person talk, you know, you subject them to the ordeal. Hence, you know, it's a well-known expression in French history. Hence, what Alleg wanted to do was show in a very, very powerful manner that France, you know, had not changed, you know, from, you know, the Middle Ages. That, in fact, it was engaging in the same practices 9 years after it fought, you know, fascism, you know, Nazism in Europe.
He wouldn't even answer the first question because he knew that if he answered one question, it would be difficult for him to not answer other ones. So he stood mum in the face of that torture. And then what was interesting was that he was able to not only write about it, but smuggle the pages of the book out of the prison as he was writing about it. Right. Tell us about that.
Yeah, he did. He was writing, you know, about what happened to him while it was still fresh in his mind. Because after you have been subjected to such an ordeal, memories get, you know, become jumbled. You know, the suffering is so intense. So he was writing, you know, what he went through on very thin paper. Some of it, I think, if I recall, was cigarette paper. People who buy, you know, cigarette tobacco in pouches and then they roll it in thin paper. That's, you know, he was writing it on that, some of it. And, you know, he had it smuggled, you know, out of the prison. And immediately, of course, you know, what arrived, you know, among his friends and his wife, you know, was, you know, immediately written down, you know, on in a hard, you know, copy. So the method itself is actually remarkably ingenious, but also showed something that is very, very interesting and important about Alleg's personality, which is that he was not going to be muzzled, he was not going to be silenced, he was going to continue to resist, and he was going to resist, you know, by spreading the word. In essence, turning the question of the question, putting it back, you know, to the French establishment. My question to you is why you're doing what you're doing.
And of course, he wrote about waterboarding.
Oh, yes, absolutely, absolutely.
And Jean-Paul Sartre wrote the introduction to his book.
Yes.
And the French government banned it, which guaranteed that it would become a bestseller.
Absolutely. And it was underground. People were buying it, you know, underground, and it became a bestseller.
So how would you evaluate the impact on that book with respect to bringing the war to a close and the driving the French out of Algeria and allowing the Algerians to have their own country back?
I don't know if because of it or thanks to it, the Algerian war ended. Because remember, this was 56-57, and the war did not end until, you know, essentially the ceasefire was in March 1962. So that was, you know, 5 to 6 years later. But what it did was contribute to discredit to a large extent the colonial government and the actions of the military. Because the various governments in France had been denying that torture was taking place in Algeria. And here you have a Frenchman, a French citizen, who was subjected to the same treatment that was meted out, you know, to Algerians. And he was talking about it in the most powerful terms. And what he said, you know, could not be denied because he bore the marks of torture in his own flesh. And that was very, very powerful. And that, of course, opened up the floodgates, you know, for others, you know, to talk about, you know, all these unsavory practices, to denounce it and so forth and so on. And I think the introduction, the preface, you know, by Jean-Paul Sartre was very, very important. And one aspect of that introduction was Sartre's pinpointing something that's very important also in Alleg's book, which is the involvement of young French soldiers, many of whom had never set foot in Algeria before, who came straight from France and therefore had not experienced, you know, the idea of colonialism, if you will. Yes, they were French citizens. They came from small towns, perhaps. Yes, they knew that their country had a huge empire, but it was still in a sort of a remote idea for them. So Sartre asked, how could such young men exhibit the same kind of hatred towards, you know, Algerians and those who supported the Algerian cause as those who were paid for doing that, or those, you know, who were very intimately implicated in the colonial system.
Marnia, we don't want to let you go without hearing how you actually met Henri.
Yes, I know.
What it was like. Yes. What did you talk about?
Right. We had a mutual friend here in the U.S. who had sent me an email once telling me that he had gotten a copy of my book on torture, and he had read it, and that, you know, he was the friend of Henri Alex. And he told him about the book, and, you know, he put me in touch with him. So that summer, I went to, this was in 2008, I went to, you know, Algeria, and, you know, going to Algeria, since there's no direct flight, you have to go through, you know, Paris. So there I called Henri, and he invited me to have dinner at his home. I brought him a copy of the book. We had a marvelous dinner, and then I was invited again the following year, because every year I go to Algeria and I pass, you know, through France. And we had another dinner, and then we kept in touch, you know, by phone, and I saw him again. I had lunch with him a few months after his wife died. Can I tell you something very personal to me? What I liked about my discussions with Henri was the fact that with him, I did not have to explain the premises of my views or my opinions. We had a sort of, you know, we had never met before, but I could talk to him and he could understand what I was talking about. We had these shared views, and in retrospect, it's because this was a highly politicized, you know, person, a great intellectual, a humanist in the best tradition of the word. And he had, you know, lived in Algeria, understood the meaning of colonialism from within. I didn't have to explain, you know, where I was coming from. Whereas, you know, for example, in New York, if I'm speaking to a colleague, I have to preface and A plus B plus C in order for them to understand the deep point that I was making. And that, to me, was so refreshing. And you can do it. I can feel that feeling only with people who have had, you know, this experience of having opposed, you know, the oppression that their country was, you know, inflicting on others.
I know exactly what you mean, Marnia, because of the feeling that I have towards people in my generation who were active in the movement against the war in Vietnam.
Right.
Really the same sort of thing. In the few minutes we have remaining, I wanted to ask you if we could tie this up and get back to the point you were making before about how Alleg wondered how these French young men who'd never been to Algeria before could be in a situation where they're actually torturing people in their own country. And isn't that exactly what American soldiers did in Iraq, which you wrote about, and Afghanistan? How do we understand that?
Yes, I mean, I'm not sure I have an answer for that. This is also, for me, a continuous question. You know, how could they, for example, you know, in Abu Ghraib, you know, in Iraq, you know, these young men and women do those horrible things, you know, to people they had never met? Well, I mean, there is the fact, you know, that political activism, you know, has diminished in this country. In the U.S., you know, the left, you know, is really very small. And something that I also discussed with Henri Alleg was also the decreased, you know, commitment, you know, of people in France whom we would normally call progressives, and the weakening of the left, you know, as a structured, you know, political presence, you know, that, you know, used to be the conscience, you know, if you will, of France. So, you know, we live in an age where humanism is a bad word. You know, we talk about anti-humanism. And remember the anti-humanist, you know, philosophy in France, you know, in the 1960, after May 68. And now it's very well established, you know, in academic institutions. You know, we teach about, you know, authors, you know, who claim to, who are proud to be anti-humanist. And this is a matter of concern for me. And this is why, for me, Alec, you know, represented perhaps, you know, one of the last figures of the humanist era, an era, you know, even though, you know, it saw Nazism and, you know, colonialism and all that, was also an era when you had people who fought for what is human in human beings, what is worth, you know, dying for, if you will, preserving that basic fundamental human dignity which characterizes all human beings regardless of their race, nationality, you know, ethnicity, color, and what have you. It is an important question, and I'm not sure I have an answer for it.
Marnie, I just wanted to ask if you could give listeners sort of a parting sentence or two about what you think Henri's contribution and legacy is going forward for people who are just learning about him.
Well, his legacy is to be on the side of humanity, of justice, and, you know, for a world in which, you know, people, human beings all over can live a decent life, life free of suffering and injustice.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Marnie.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.